You're listening to a program produced in 2018 by Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place at the historic Central Library in downtown Los Angeles. Aloud is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more, please visit lfla.org/aloud. The doors of emigration, the portals to new worlds, are all around us. Here in Los Angeles, we strive to welcome the new arrivals who've passed through those portals, seeking refuge. Mohsen Hamid's novel, Exit West, is mesmerizing as we follow two migrants, Saeed and Nadia, who leave an unnamed country in the middle of civil war, journeying first to Greece, England, and eventually the United States, as they create new lives for themselves far from their traditional home. You know, you can't read this magnificent novel without thinking of our fellow human beings in Ghouta, in Myanmar, in the too many places in our interconnected world riven by war and violence or roiled by climate change. What happens when countries narrow the definition of who belongs? Then who gets to stay? Who must flee? And what might the world look like if people moved freely, like the birds that recognize no borders? And how might we envision the future on a warming planet as populations shift to find a way to live their lives in peace and to feed their families? Will it mean better music, better food, kimchi on our tortillas like in L.A.? Mohsen Hamid noted in an interview, quote, "If Copenhagen is like Rio de Janeiro in 100 years, maybe people of Copenhagen will think it's a disaster, but maybe their grandchildren will think it's fantastic." We last welcomed Mohsen a few years ago when he came to Aloud to discuss his novel, How to Get Filthy Rich in Rising Asia, with fellow novelist David Troyer, a conversation that you can find on our digital archive. And tonight he'll be interviewed by Viet Thanh Nguyen, whom we are delighted to welcome back to Aloud as well. Mohsen Hamid has divided his life between Pakistan and Britain and the United States. He currently lives in Lahore, Pakistan, with his family. In addition to the titles I've mentioned, he's also the author of The Reluctant Fundamentalist and Moth Smoke, and a book of essays, Discontent and Its Civilizations, Dispatches from Lahore, New York, and London. And his work has been translated into over 35 languages, adapted for the cinema, and twice shortlisted for the Man Booker Prize. Viet Thanh Nguyen last interviewed the young poet Ocean Vuong for us. Viet was born in Vietnam in 1971, fled to the United States with his family after the fall of Saigon. He recently edited a fantastic anthology, The Displaced, Refugee Writers on Refugee Lives, which I highly recommend, and we have for sale tonight. His novel, The Sympathizer, won the Pulitzer Prize, and he's also the author of the story collection, The Refugees. He is happily on sabbatical from USC right now, where he teaches in the English and American Studies Department. Both of our authors will be signing books after tonight's program. Please join me in welcoming Mohsen Hamid and Viet Thanh Nguyen.
Thank you very much for that introduction, and to my friend Viet for agreeing to be here with me this evening, and to all of you for coming out on a weeknight. I'm just going to read very briefly from Exit West, and then we're going to sit down and have a conversation. I'll read the first couple of pages, so those of you who haven't read the book have some idea of what it's about and how it starts, and then a brief passage from towards the end. This is how the book begins. In a city swollen by refugees but still mostly at peace, or at least not yet openly at war, a young man met a young woman in a classroom and did not speak to her for many days. His name was Saeed and her name was Nadia, and he had a beard. Not a full beard, more a studiously maintained stubble. And she was always clad from the tips of her toes to the bottom of her jugular notch in a flowing black robe. Back then, people continued to enjoy the luxury of wearing more or less what they wanted to wear, clothing and hair-wise, within certain bounds, of course. And so these choices meant something. It might seem odd that in cities teetering at the edge of the abyss, young people still go to class. in this case, an evening class on corporate identity and product branding. But that is the way of things, with cities as with life. For one moment, we are pottering about our errands as usual, and the next, we are dying. And our internally impending ending does not put a stop to our transient beginnings and middles until the instant when it does. Said noticed that Nadia had a beauty mark on her neck, a tawny oval that sometimes, rarely but not never, moved with her pulse. Not long after noticing this, Said spoke to Nadia for the first time. Their city had yet to experience any major fighting, just some shootings and the odd car bombing, felt in one's chest cavity as a subsonic vibration, like those emitted by large loudspeakers at music concerts. And Said and Nadia had packed up their books and were leaving class. In the stairwell, he turned to her and said, "Listen, would you like to have a coffee?" And after a brief pause, added, to make it seem less forward, given her conservative attire, "In the cafeteria." Nadia looked him in the eye. "You don't say your evening prayers?" she asked. Said conjured up his most endearing grin. Not always, sadly. Her expression did not change. So he persevered, clinging to his grin with the mounting desperation of a doomed rock climber. "I think it's personal. Each of us has his own way, or her own way. Nobody's perfect. And in any case..." She interrupted him. "I don't pray," she said. She continued to gaze at him steadily. Then she said, "Maybe another time." He watched as she walked out to the student parking area, and there, instead of covering her head with a black cloth, as he expected, she donned a black motorcycle helmet that had been locked to a scuffed-up 100-ish cc trail bike, snapped down her visor, straddled her ride, and drove off, disappearing with a controlled rumble into the gathering dusk. And that's how it begins. Said meets Nadia. They fall for each other. Their city falls into a violent crisis, and they're forced to flee. And they flee by means of these black doors that begin to open up all over the world. And alongside them, millions, billions of people move. And in the novel, as we follow their story as they go from their city to Europe to California, we occasionally encounter other people, in some cases unrelated to, say, the Nadia, who are experiencing this new world in different ways. And I want to read just another short passage about one of these people. "Not far to the south, in the town of Palo Alto, lived an old woman who had lived in the same house her entire life. Her parents had brought her to this house when she was born, and her mother had passed on there when she was a teenager, and her father when she was in her 20s, and her husband had joined her there, and her two children had grown up in this house, and she had lived alone with them when she divorced, and later with her second husband, their stepfather, and her children had moved off to college and not returned, and her second husband had died 2 years ago, and throughout this time she had never moved. Traveled, yes, but never moved. And yet it seemed the world had moved, and she barely recognized the town that existed outside her property. The old woman had become a rich woman on paper, the house now worth a fortune, and her children were always pestering her to sell it, saying she didn't need all that space. But she told them to be patient. It would be theirs when she died, which wouldn't be long now. And she said this kindly, to sharpen the bite of it, and to remind them how much they were motivated by money. Money they spent without having, which she had never done, always saving for a rainy day, even if only a little. One of her granddaughters went to the great university nearby, a university that had gone from being a local seeker to among the world's most famous in the space of the old woman's lifetime. This granddaughter came to see her, often as much as once a week. She was the only one of the old woman's descendants who did this, and the old woman adored her, and also sometimes felt baffled by her. Looking at her granddaughter, she thought she saw what she would have looked like had she been born in China. For the granddaughter had features of the old woman, and yet looked to the old woman, overall, more or less, but mostly more, Chinese. There was a rise that led up to the old woman's street, and when she was a little girl, the old woman used to push her bike up and then get on and zoom back down without pedaling. Bikes being heavy in those days and hard to take uphill, especially when you were small, as she was then, and your bike too big, as hers had been. She'd like to see how far she could glide without stopping, flashing through the intersections, ready to brake, but not overly ready, because there had been a lot less traffic, at least as far as she could remember. She had always had carp in a mossy pond in the back of her house, carp that her granddaughter called goldfish, and she had known the names of almost everyone on her street, and most had been there a long time. They were old California, from families that were California families. But over the years, they had changed more and more rapidly, and now she knew none of them, and saw no reason to make the effort, for people bought and sold houses the way they bought and sold stocks, and every year someone was moving out and someone was moving in. And now all these doors from who knows where were opening, and all sorts of strange people were around, people who looked more at home than she was, even the homeless ones who spoke no English, more at home maybe because they were younger. And when she went out, it seemed to her that she too had migrated, that everyone migrates, even if we stay in the same houses our whole lives, because we can't help it. We are all migrants through time. Thank you. Yep.
Well, such a pleasure to be here with you. The last time we saw each other was in New York City at the New Yorker Festival. A couple other people were on the panel, so now it's just you and me.
Yes.
Having this conversation. And, you know, Exit West is a book that's near and dear to my heart, partly because I reviewed it for the New York Times.
But very kindly.
Also because it's about, or at least partly about, the global refugee crisis. So let's start off with an easy question. How do we solve the global refugee crisis?
Well, I think that there's a, I guess, a long-run solution and a short-run solution. In the long run, I think that the notion that people should be entitled to fundamentally different rights, including where they should live or can live based on where they were born, will no longer be accepted as humane by our species in a century or two. You know, if we think that men and women are equal, and that we think that people with dark and light skin are equal, and that gay and straight people are equal, and religious and non-religious people are equal, the notion that somebody born, you know, in Mogadishu and somebody born in Milwaukee have fundamentally different entitlements to whether they can live safely strikes me as unlikely to be maintained. So I think eventually we're going to figure out that, that we cannot have equality unless we really have equality. And that means not denying it to people, you know, on the basis of where they come from. But that'll take a while. And in the meantime, I think that part of the failing is, the short-term part of it is, we need to begin to articulate optimistic visions of where we can go together. That it's that we are failing to say that, you know, if these people come to America, they do not rob America and threaten America. They add to America and replenish America and make a better America possible. And similarly in Europe, etc. So I think starting to recognize that every migrant, every refugee brings with them the possibility of a future, and articulating what kind of futures there could be and why those futures are better than the totalitarian police states that we will have to become to prevent them from coming. To me, that's at the heart of what we have to do sort of now.
I mean, I know that I've read many of your interviews and so on, and you're an optimist when it comes to this question of human progress. And you've stated that it's more of a human natural inclination to focus on the negative things that are happening and not recognizing how much we've changed and progressed as a species over the past several thousand years. So we're no longer killing each other because we come from different city-states. We're just doing it because of religions or because of national identities and so on. So yes, we made some progress. So it's good to be optimistic. I'm optimistic too, because I actually do believe that that is true. But the pessimistic part is also what I find really interesting. And as a novelist, the pessimistic part is always the more fun part. So pessimistically, how difficult is it going to be to change some of these things that lead to refugee crises in the first place? You know, as writers, we have autonomy. We can write our books. We can be as optimistic as we want, or we can, you know, extol the virtues of literature, and that's all very crucial in the necessity of changing the human imagination. And that's partly what we do as writers. But in the meantime, you know, we have to worry about war machines and climate catastrophes and things like that. Are we going to survive these things before literature can do its work? Because literature takes a while.
Well, I think that we're not going to survive, actually, as individuals. But as a species, we are likely to. Part of what's happening is there's a disconnect between the individual plight of the human being, which is that none of us get out alive, and what happens to our species. And I think that very often what's occurring is that each generation that passes, not always, not sequentially, but in general over time, is a little bit less comfortable with difference, a little bit less more closed than subsequent ones. So I think that partly these things take time just because people have to go and younger people have to grow up. But also, I think, as far as pessimism versus optimism is concerned, I don't think we can just sort of sit back and be optimistic. I think that that optimism has to be fought for. We have to articulate optimistic visions. We have to address pessimistic concerns. We have to be very realistic about the kind of politics and the kind of writing and the kind of engagement and the kind of people we have to be. But for me, there's one very big thing, when the whole notion of optimism and pessimism. It's a central theme, I think, related to these two sides of this coin, is the question of transience and impermanence, right? Becoming comfortable with transience and the fact that everything ends is very important. This is part of every human culture since the beginning of, you know, human history. How do we become comfortable with everything changing and the fact that we will each lose everything that we have by the end of our individual lives? Part of the problem at the moment is we are being promised permanence, and we are being told that impermanence can be denied. We're being told that Islam can be again the way it was 1,000 years ago, or America can be again the way it was 50 years ago, or that we can be young forever, or that if we eat a vegan diet and do our Pilates religiously, we'll live to be forever, perhaps, until they can, you know. And we are failing to reckon with, accept temporariness. It's a huge, I think, cultural, civilizational failure, and it's happening partly because some of the mechanisms like religion that we had to deal with this before are being tribalized and politicized and de-spiritualized in the process. And then the non-religious mechanisms that are growing so strong very often are about either a kind of marketing to our insecurities, you know, which is what the market tends to do, or the creation of some kind of, you know, national objective, which doesn't really address our personal needs and concerns. I think that actually it's very important to think, how do we once again become comfortable and honest with a state of impermanence, which changes the dynamic of what optimism and pessimism actually mean. Optimism isn't that I'll live forever. Optimism is, in the face of a recognized temporary life, I can still find beauty and meaning and connection and something worthwhile. And for me, that kind of shift is actually very, very important.
Well, part of what you're talking about is that the part of the impermanence is due to the fact that we live in a globally capitalizing world, and capitalism feeds on impermanence. It feeds on change, right? But at the same time, one of the things that capitalism is selling us is, as you were saying, this desire, this nostalgic desire for the lost past, for purity, for easy solutions, and the like. And you are someone who actually has a relationship with capitalism in a very, in a fairly real way. Like I am basically a creature of academia.
Yeah.
Okay. My only real job has been in the university, and then I'm a writer. Okay. You have actually been a consultant. Now, frankly, I have no idea what that means. Okay. You hear about corporations calling in their consultants, and you know, what are they actually doing? But in The Reluctant Fundamentalist, your second novel, your protagonist, Changes, is that how you pronounce it?
Changes.
Changes.
Yeah.
Is a Pakistani foreign student who is in the United States, who's very smart, and he becomes a consultant. And he works within the belly of the beast. He works within global capitalism from the heart of, from its heart, as you did, right?
Yeah.
So given your intimate experience and given some of the things that you've thought about in writing your books, including The Reluctant Fundamentalist, should we be optimistic about capitalism's capacity to not screw us over in the end?
Well, I think the thing about capitalism isn't one thing, right? If you don't have regulations in capitalism, you have the jungle. There's no capitalism without regulation, right? And then the question is, how do you regulate the thing? If you're scared of the Soviet Union and you have 90% marginal tax rates and you're developing increasing protections for people as America was doing after the Second World War, that's one kind of capitalism. Another kind of capitalism is almost, very, very low tax rates, no social protections, very little regulation as currently exists in the United States. You can call both those things capitalism. So capitalism is different stuff. Capitalism basically harnesses self-interest, gives it a kind of rule-based system to play in, and tells people to go off and play and try to make more money for themselves. And it can be quite brutal, but the regulation, like in any sporting activity, determines it, right? If it's boxing, that's brutal, but it's not as brutal as knifing somebody or gouging somebody's eyes out. And boxing is more brutal than soccer, which is more brutal than pool. How you regulate the thing matters. But I'm not, I suppose, opposed to capitalism, but I do think that there are incredibly different ways of regulating what we call the market. And at the moment, we have disastrous ways of doing it. But that said, I also don't think, I think that capitalism is not a, to the extent that capitalism is about each of us acting in our self-interest and maximizing the benefit to ourself, it is a very, very weak and insufficient tool with which to approach the problem that our self will cease to exist. A self-maximizing system is intrinsically poorly designed to confront the human existential reality that we, the self goes away. And so therefore, we've seen throughout human history other systems, right? So, there is, for example, if you could imagine within certain strands of Buddhism, the notion that you inhabit the present moment so thoroughly that the past begins to disappear as a kind of memory, and the future is a sort of illusion. And in that moment where you are actually present in this moment and have expanded the capacity of this moment to such a degree, the terror of what is to come and the anguish of what has been lost recede. That is one mechanism to approach this. Or if you look at, for example, the mystical strand of Sufism within Islam, or sort of Martin Buber's I Thou mystical approach to Judaism or many other similar things. These are sort of love-based theologies, and what they say is that if we love enough, and we love in a non-possessive sort of way, we allow ourselves to be attached to something, someone, or some entity other than ourselves, our lover, our child, divine, the universe, whatever, that the strength of that love makes possible a diminishment of our own fear of what happens to us. And this is why, for example, my father, who plays with his grandkid every day before he goes to work, is excited about the next year when the treehouse will be built, and 5 years after that when her, you know, new bicycle will be there, and she'll be doing this and that, even though his best friend passed away last year and his brother passed away 2 years before. And if you think forward for him, what does time involve? But love for his granddaughter allows a certain excitement about the future to manifest itself really in his life. And I guess what I'm trying to say is that human culture is full of traditions that do help us approach this question of the impermanent self. Capitalism, for me, is kind of value neutral. It's what you do with it that determines the values of it. But whatever you do with it, it is unlikely to be a complete answer, and certainly it's not a complete answer to this question that we're talking about, which is how do we as human beings confront the reality of what it means to be a human being?
So your work is really good at bringing up these bigger ideas, right? These abstractions about capitalism or cultural change or global migration and so on, but also locating them very specifically with certain kinds of people, certain kinds of populations. So in The Reluctant Fundamentalist, our protagonist, Changiz, his identity is actually very important as someone who's Pakistani in New York City at the time of 9/11. And he goes from being this, you know, pretty easygoing, cosmopolitan foreign student into someone who becomes this possibly reluctant fundamentalist, right? And one way to imagine him is that he's not just Pakistani, but he's Asian. Right? And you have another book called How to Get Filthy Rich in Rising Asia. And when I read the book, I read him as Pakistani, but I also read him as Asian American in the sense that he is this figure who embodies or represents migratory populations who have one foot in both cultures. And the anthropologist Aiwa Ong, in her book Flexible Citizenship, argues that Asian Americans, broadly construed, are the shock troops of global capitalism. Mm. Precisely because they have a foot in both cultures. They are Asian and American. They move back and forth easily. They're flexible and so on. That describes your protagonist.
Yep.
Describes you as well. So I'm wondering what your thoughts are about that. Is that an accurate description of that protagonist? Is that an accurate description of the place of bicultural, migratory, cosmopolitan people in this world?
It's really interesting. I think, well, let me take it one piece at a time. Changiz does come to feel this about himself. In the novel, he's working for this consulting firm. He winds up in the Philippines, and he sort of presents himself as kind of American because with an American company in the Philippines. But he's aware of how the Filipinos are looking at him and the sense of, you know, is he, you know, what is his position relative to these Americans? A kind of almost hostility that he picks up on, even if it may not be there. Who knows if he's seeing it or if he's feeling it within himself. And then he goes to Chile, and he is told by a Chilean executive at this company, publisher, that he reminds the Chilean executive of the Janissaries. And the Janissaries in the Ottoman Empire were the children, the orphaned children of these Turkish, predominantly, you know, Muslim armies coming into Europe, and orphaned Christian boys who were then taken into the empire and trained as its ultimate soldiers and then were deployed back into the very regions where they had come from and were thought to be the most effective and the shock troops. And so this history of the person who is of one and has sort of burnt their bridges from the place that they originated in and have now attached themselves to a new place and can be deployed against that place even more forcefully is something with a history much older in a way than global capitalism as we understand it today. And Changiz, confronted with this and many other things, sort of starts saying, you know, what the hell am I doing? He you know, decides to opt out and grows a beard, and what he exactly is and who he becomes sort of depends on what you, the reader, think he is and becomes, because the novel is in a way more of a mirror than it is a sketch of his politics, at least. But I think that so it is possible for this kind of hybridity to be, you know, employed as the shock troop of global capital. It's also, though, possible for many other things to occur. you know, so many of the great independence leaders of Asia were hybrid figures of this kind. Gandhi, Jinnah in the case of Pakistan, so many of the East Asian independence figures had spent some time in Paris or in London or in America. And so we see alternative things as well, right, where far from being the shock troops of global capitalism, there was a redeployment of certain expectations and norms. And that's, you know, like Martin Luther King in a way, who used a certain kind of rhetoric, redeployed it for a sort of liberation purpose. As far as Asian Americans are concerned, you know, as the shock troops, maybe to a certain extent we have seen so much enterprise and whatever, businesses and going back, but I wouldn't generalize in that way. I think that there are many different kinds of Asian American, and there are, you know, many very subversive types of Asian American and many other variations on what that means. And I think also that something is beginning to shift. The ability to ascribe to oneself a notion of whiteness, which is something that all of us who are something in between in the American pigmentocracy, something in between whiteness and, you know, and blackness, those of us in the middle have kind of often had a chance to position ourselves at least to a little degree and imagine that we could subsume ourselves into whiteness. And I think it does feel to me that opportunity is narrowing, and that you know, either to accept one's non-whiteness and to advocate for a post-white kind of reality feels much more fertile and likely attractive to the future generations of Asian American than the idea that they will be true Janissaries who subsume themselves into whiteness and function in that way. I think that's not where we're headed.
Well, part of what you point out in your answer is that there's obviously always going to be this oscillation, never one thing or the other, right? And I can think back to the history of Vietnam, for example. Ho Chi Minh was one of these figures who was a hybrid and traveled all over the world and was a cosmopolitan and went back, started a revolution and so on. And lo and behold, 50 or 60 years later, the communist revolution that he founded is basically a capitalist party.
Okay? Yeah.
It oscillates back and forth. And you've identified yourself as a migrant and a mongrel. I think this is the terms that
yeah.
you have used, and that also describes Changez as well in the book. And also describes, you know, much of the literature that you and I work with and have written ourselves. You know, we're both deeply interested in these questions of mongrelization or hybridity or the mixing of different cultures and so on. And for me and for you, I think these are all positives, right? But because what we do in the literature that we create and that we enjoy is caught up in forces beyond our control, that oscillation
yeah.
starts to factor come into play. And this is a problem that I think about a lot, and I want to ask you if you've thought about it, which is that for those of us who are writers of color, however you want to define that,
mm-hmm.
you know, we're migrant writers, we're minority writers, we're writers of color, we are part of that oscillation. You know, we depict the mongrelization and the diversity and the hybridity, all these things that are wonderful for a certain kind of audience, but are we somehow preventing change from taking place? In depicting these conditions of refugees and migrants and all that other stuff, which audiences all over the world are interested in, are we helping or are we actually stabilizing the situation?
I don't know. I mean, it's a good question. How does it, what actually happens because of these books, you know, if anything? Certainly one hopes that one is helping. Is it possible that the literature or the writing of is stabilizing the situation? It might be. It's not certainly at least my intention to do that. It's my intention to do precisely the opposite. But I want to say two things in response to that. The first thing is that, I mean, certainly I'm a writer of color, but the color that I am is kind of the middle of the color spectrum in the place which I live, which is Pakistan, right? So in an American context, I'm a writer of color. In a Pakistani context, I'm a Pakistani writer. And I'm in both of those contexts, and in a British context, and wherever you find me. One thing which I've experienced by going back to Pakistan is I live in the same house that I lived as a child. My children are the fourth generation of children in my family to live in this same house. My grandparents passed away in that house. My parents are now grandparents in that house. I, who was a child, am now parents, and my kids are now the grandchildren in the same house. And so a lot of the stuff that I'm trying to write about, mixing, mongrelization, etc., I think is occurring not simply across national lines or, you know, as a function of us moving from here to there, but can also be observed by staying very, very still in one place and just looking around. Lahore is experiencing enormous mongrelization and migration. You know, I once asked my grandparents, my grandfather, you know, what the biggest, most impactful event of his life was. Was it the Second World War or the nuclear bomb? He said it was the partition of India and Pakistan, because within the space of 1 month, two-thirds of his neighbors and friends left, and he never saw them again. You know, the notion that there was some sort of stasis in which people lived before without these massive movements and churn simply is not true. There has always been massive movement and churn. And I think what I find, for me, an advantage, I think, of living in Pakistan, for me personally, in how I see things, is I no longer sort of pathologize myself as this atypical human being. I now tend to think that everybody is an atypical human being, and that, in fact, this mongrelized migratory thing is something that we all participate in. You know, if you live in America, you can be made to feel different, or like, you know, you're talking about migration, but other people don't experience it. You're talking about mongrelization, other people don't experience it. There's no mongrel category in the world, perhaps more, you know, completely mongrelized than the category of whiteness in the United States. You know, whiteness is an absolutely mongrelized term. There is no such thing. There were Poles and Italians and, you know, Germans and whatnot. And then one day, they, you know, we've crafted this thing, whiteness. Okay, so that is a fundamentally mongrelized situation. And where did these people come from? They didn't evolve in California, right? They came here. And so I think what happens, the nice thing for me about being in Pakistan is I get to reset my stance of like what is normal and what is not normal. And so I think that actually there are mongrels, and that there are people who don't recognize that they are mongrels, but there's nobody who isn't one. And so to this point, the question of, you know, are we locking the system into place or unlocking the system? It's hard to say, but I think that there's a fundamental truth in this, and articulating that truth will hopefully unlock things. But am I right? Is it actually true? And will it do those things? You know, I don't know.
Well, I think you're right that everybody's a mongrel, and that some people recognize it and some people don't.
Yeah.
Right? And that part of having a privilege as a part of a majority in any society, whether it's in Pakistan or here in the United States, is being able to deny that mongrelization, being able to deny that hybridity, or privileging that hybridity and stigmatizing someone else's hybridity.
Yeah.
So no, I think there are a lot of white Americans who are very proud of the fact that they can trace their lineage to the English and the Irish and the German and the Scotch and whatever.
Yeah.
They go into long discussion about their ancestors and everything like that. But they're not necessarily that interested in the other kind of mongrelization or hybridity, right?
Yeah.
They're not interested in that's coming from outside of these borders. So when I was reading your last novel, How to Get Filthy Rich in Rising Asia, which is set in sort of a nameless city, if I remember right? But it's definitely Asia because it's in the title of the book.
Yeah.
Okay. It's not Vietnam, for example. It's not these Asian cities that I'm familiar with personally, but I would recognize it nevertheless because I recognize that mongrelization that was taking place in your nameless city. It's a very Asian mongrelization, corruption, people on the fast track to try to climb the economic ladder, doing everything they can, cutting corners, selling corrupted goods, these kinds of things. I'm at home. I know all this from Vietnam. So I feel that it's maybe the same thing that when people who are white read books about other white people and they're not like from France, for example, but they'll think, ooh, I feel familiar with Paris. Or, oh, I feel familiar with London.
Yeah.
I thought, I feel familiar with this nameless Asian city.
Well.
And the where I'm going with this is that it's touching on what you brought up earlier, which is that you know, you're situating yourself as the norm in your own work, right? And there, I think there's definitely that project going on in all of your books. You're dealing with migration, you're dealing with religious fundamentalism, you're dealing with capitalism in Asia, all these kinds of things. But you're treating them as the norm, and you're treating these experiences as universal experiences. And you're claiming that the refugee experience or the migrant experience from Asia to the West or within Asia are universal experiences. And I think this is actually a major thing to make a claim about. It's a major sort of, you know, artistic move, political move that many of us who are of that same situation want to claim for ourselves too. That we don't have to write about France or the United States or England to be universal. We can write about rising Asia.
Yeah.
And was that a part of your thinking as you were, you know, basically over the course of your career in the last four books?
Yeah, I mean, in that book, How to Get Filters in Rising Asia, I started with the standpoint of saying, what if Lahore is the universal city? Like, what if in Lahore, where I live, is this archetype of what a city is and who people are? And I think that actually every place and every person has equal claim to universality, which is to say a conditional claim, right? We can each equally claim universality. But some places have not really staked their claim to universality very much. So the novel about New York or the novel about Paris in a different century or about London in the intervening century between those two centuries was the novel about the city, you know? Why can't a novel about Lahore be the novel about the city? It certainly can. And so I began with a supposition of, let's just pretend that it is. And the namelessness was helpful in that because what happens is either you have names that have now become part of a kind of international branded vocabulary, which everybody knows, you know, Wall Street and Fifth Avenue, etc. And when you use them, it sort of reinforces your claim to universality. Or you have names that people don't know, which sort of reinforces your position as this exotic place with funny-sounding names. And so I thought, I'm going to strip away the names and just talk about how things work and what people feel and what they're like and hopefully speak about this universal place, which I situate in Asia, but you know, I'm open to being read as an African or Latin American or even North American city if you choose to do so. But yes, I think you know, claiming the universal position for me is very interesting. Also, it doesn't mean denying the weirdness and particularity of each, you know, person and each fiction. I think that it is nice to embrace complete idiosyncratic weirdness and universality at the same time, in part because weirdness is a human universal. Like, everybody is weird. Without essentializing that a man is this and woman is this, keeping it about characters, but yes, that is part of the project. And in a way, I suppose returning to Pakistan and living in Pakistan after many, many years abroad, you know, part of what there are many motivations for doing that. You know, not least the desire to, you know, be near my parents and my wife to be near her parents as they were getting older, which is how I grew up. Which is like a cultural, you know, I suppose, value that one, you know, absorbed and values. But also, I liked the idea of being able to write in this way, of not having to think of myself as a minority unless I chose to. But at the same time, going to Pakistan and discovering what a minority I am inside Pakistan also, right? That, like, my way of thinking and who I am. And, you know, going back to Pakistan allowed me to, I guess, feel that everybody is a minority of one. You know, that we each feel kind of foreign wherever we are. There's just something about being a person, which is, if we really let us get in touch with it, we do feel foreign. anywhere.
In Pakistan, do the Pakistani literary people call you a Pakistani writer, or do they call you something else, or like a Pakistani writer with a qualification of some kind? Because I mean, Vietnam, when I won the Pulitzer Prize, be like, he's a Vietnamese writer.
Yeah.
And but so of course. But they also, you know, more often talk about me as being a Vietnamese writer living in the United States, Vietnamese American writer. So it's rarely that I'm just a Vietnamese writer, except in the context of the Pulitzer Prize.
Yeah.
So you have this very interesting background where you've been back and forth over several different countries and so on. You live in Pakistan, but you write in English. Yeah. Which I assume is not the national language.
No.
It's the language of the elite. So how are you seen as a writer?
Well, I think that it sort of depends, right? So people who like me often think that I'm a very Pakistani writer. People who don't like me think that I'm this, you know, I guess, foreign-influenced whatever. But I make it a point to assert that I'm a foreign-influenced whatever whenever I present myself. If I try to do interviews when I speak, I say, look, you know, I've lived abroad half of my life. I speak English better than I speak Urdu or any Pakistani language. I've had a particular experience. You know, I'm really not more Pakistani than I am potentially American, even though I'm not a U.S. citizen or British or whatever. I try to assert my own mongrelness in Pakistan. But I at the same time tried to remind people that, you know, Pakistan is a mongrel country, that yes, English is the language of the elite, but so is Urdu. Urdu is the first language of maybe 10% of Pakistanis. Most Pakistanis at home grew up speaking Punjabi, Pashto, Saraiki, Sindhi, you know, their Baloch or their Kashmiris or their Urdu too is an elite language in a sense in Pakistan. And so the average Pakistani kid goes to school and they're taught in this language, Urdu, which they don't speak at home, and they sort of have to learn this language. And they go to college and then they're taught, well, you know, you have to speak English now, and they don't speak English, you have to learn English. And so there's a series, if you wanted to design an educational system that discouraged critical thinking and made it as difficult as possible to learn, Pakistan is a very useful, you know, model. Now, that said, by the time people get to college, very often they have recognized that English is the language of the constitution, it's the language of business, and if you want to work abroad or get out of Pakistan, it's the language that will get you out. And so on college campuses, much of the education is in English. And I think much of the reading that's going on is in English. And so, you know, my readers in Pakistan are not sort of necessarily elite, you know, ex-New York consultants like myself. They are very often college students who maybe have read no other novel in their lives. I can't tell you how many times I meet somebody in Pakistan who will say, oh, I liked your book very much. It's the only novel I've ever read. and I find that actually wonderful. I mean, in a sense, you know, not from an industry standpoint, but just from the standpoint of... And I think that say this in Pakistan very often also, is that, you know, I accept that I am a very atypical Pakistani, but so is everybody else. I don't accept that because I write in English, I am somehow inauthentically Pakistani. I'm inauthentically Pakistani because I've lived outside Pakistan a lot. But nobody's authentically Pakistani. And in Pakistan, for me, we systematically deny people's Pakistaniness on the basis of the religious group or the religious subsect or the linguistic group or this or that or the other. And I'm entirely opposed to that position. For me, if you live in Pakistan, as far as I'm concerned, I don't really care what passport you have. If you say you're Pakistani, you live there, I think of you as Pakistani. For me, an Afghan refugee who lives in Pakistan and is not a citizen but wants to be Pakistani should be. And then when I meet these young readers, very often they're from very non-elite, you know, sort of backgrounds. I myself, because of, you know, living here and working in business and all these things, are from a very different kind of I suppose, socioeconomic sliver now. I guess it's my suspicion that university students in Pakistan today are more likely to be reading a novel in English than they are in Urdu, or as likely. And that the place in the world where I am most likely to be recognized by a reader and come up to and spoken to is Pakistan, particularly a campus in Pakistan. So I feel part of that place. That said, because I don't write in Urdu, and Urdu is the dominant literary language in Pakistan, there is this kind of, you know, you are an upstart, you belong to something else, we've done it better, you've only been recognized because you write in English. And partly that's sour grapes, and partly that's true, right? Partly it's like, well, we wish that we had gotten this international acclaim. And partly it is that there is actually amazing Urdu language fiction and other language fiction, which is not getting this acclaim because it's not in English. So there's both truth to criticism, as well as, you know, I think a degree of sort of a sense that this isn't fair, and it isn't. Writing in English in that sense is opens up an international audience for you.
I'm going to follow up with one last question, but before we get to that, I just want to remind people that we're going to have a Q&A. So if you have questions, start thinking about them now. We'll take them after this last question for Mohsen. On that last issue that you raised, and I, you know, I want to talk a little bit about Exit West here. This Exit West and all of your other novels are written in a particular style that is easy to read. Literally, it should probably take you 4, 5, 6 hours to read some of these novels that Mohsen has written, and it's a very, very deliberate style that you've chosen. And at least in Exit West and in the previous novel, How to Get Filthy Rich in Rising Asia, there's a very deliberate stripping of specificity from your locales that are set in Asia. You know, there's no names for the cities, yeah, for example. And I think I understand why you're doing that, but also, is this also a trajectory in your work towards deliberately writing a more global novel? Writing in a language, in a style that's easy to read, which is not to say that it's easy to write.
You know, yeah, no, I know what you mean, yeah.
But also, you know, deliberately setting your novels in a global fashion, partly as this claim to universality, but also as this literary ambition, possibly.
Well, I think that on the easy-to-read standpoint, I think, you know, so many of the people I know in Pakistan and see regularly don't read fiction or read so little of it. I suppose not living in New York or London anymore, where I was surrounded by people who were also writers or went to the same universities I went to or worked in publishing, and my imagined idea of what a reader was perhaps shaped by this. Living in Pakistan, you know, I have a different attitude of what I think a reader is. And so the idea for me is that I don't want to compromise on the complexity of you know, the rigor of what a sentence can do, or what form can achieve, or what complexity of character or theme or politics can be embedded in a book. But I don't think one needs to compromise on one can still be rigorous about those things, or try to be as rigorous as one can be, while at the same time offering up to the reader a book that enables itself to be read, that is small and less intimidating for being small. And particularly in the last book, Exit West, which is in some senses formally more simple than some of the previous ones. I think they're all simple in a way, but maybe a little bit more daunting, like How to Get Filthy Rich in Rising Asia as a second-person self-help book that's also a novel. So it's formally a bit, you know, weird. I mean, they're all weird, but that one is very weird. And I thought, you know, in this moment, when I began writing with Motsumug, my first novel, and it's this trial, surreal trial, where all the characters are telling the story and you, the reader, are cast as the judge of the surreal trial. You're spoken to in the second person. And still, it's hopefully a page-turner, but with a very weird form. That novel was written in reaction to a Pakistan that I grew up in the 1980s, where General Zia-ul-Haq was Islamizing the country, and we were told you had to be pure, and there was no alcohol, and police busted if you went on dates, and dance, public performances of dance were banned. And so writing a novel in Pakistan, which means the land of the pure, about fundamentally impure characters doing fundamentally impure things, and being untrustworthy and cynical was a, for me, necessary reaction to this, you know, condition. But today, when the most powerful people in the world tell us that there is no truth and that there is no decency, I think it is very important to consider whether an appropriate artistic reaction is to try to write a novel that says exactly what it means about people who are trying to be decent. And that's what Exit West tries to do. And formally, in many ways, I thought, how do you write a novel like that? And then I thought, children's books. That's literature that does this so well. They contain within themselves their own decoder ring. And they have a kind of double partisan structure where the narrator is on the side of the character cheering for Wilbur not to die and Charlotte to live, but also for you, that you are on the same side as them. And I thought, what a powerful approach. And so that's formally what came into this book, and in a way, why it's written in that way, which is hopefully open to being read. I'll answer very shortly on the global thing. Is it's not so much that I believe in the global novel. Partly my move to namelessness has been dictated by making evident in an environment that compels self-censorship. Self-censorship is going on. And if we can't say whatever we want, which we cannot say in a place like Pakistan, let us make blanks very clear. This country shall not be named. This religion shall not be named. These things shall not be named. Why? Because we cannot speak freely of these things. So let's not name them and speak as freely as we can in an unnamed world, more than for the globalization impact of it. And in Exit West, it was partly the namelessness was because I didn't want to contribute to the narrative of Pakistan going down to decline and collapse and my city, Lahore, you know, turning into this terrorist thing, because there's so much of that about Pakistan. And yet I wanted to use Lahore as my template to start off. So it was more these kind of things than an aspiration towards globalism. I think for me, globalism is less attractive than looking for universals in particulars. It's less that I'm trying to write about the globe and more that I'm trying to write about individuals. But in those individual human beings are things that hopefully readers can recognize in themselves. So going forward, will I write nameless novels? I don't know. I hopefully would try to write very particular books. The last thing I want to say on this is I think that we live in a world where branding has utterly changed language and where words no longer mean what we intend them to mean. We use words that have been given meanings, proper nouns in particular, by other people, and it can be useful to take away the proper nouns and describe the thing for what it is, because words like Islam, America, Pakistan, etc., have been hijacked. We cannot use them anymore and have them mean what we intend. So let's not use them sometimes and describe these things in our own words.
Thank you for those answers. Yeah. And there are people going around with mics in the audience. So if you want to raise your hand, they'll come to you.
Could you tell me your thinking behind keeping Nadia in her black robe as she progressed over time into new spaces?
Yeah, I mean, you know, so the character Nadia in the novel is described wearing this black robe, a conservative black robe. It's not fully described. It's not clear exactly what this thing is, but we have a kind of suggestion. In a way, what I realized coming back to Pakistan was, in my family, nobody wears a garment like that. So, my grandmother was the chairperson of the All Pakistan Women's Association. You could say a kind of, you know, women's rights activist from many, many decades ago. And there's a very strong Western educational tradition in my family, etc. So I had certain, you could say, assumptions about what it meant to dress in this way that were utterly shattered by moving back to Pakistan. I met one time I was standing outside the door of my house, and this woman was walking up to me, walking up the driveway very, you know, forcefully and speedily, straight at me, dressed in this way. And I thought, you know, who is this person? Why is she walking up in my house? Well, you know, who? And then she sort of flips off her hood, and it's my wife's friend who has become this TV actress. And I said, you know, are you coming from a set? Were you shooting a show? She goes, no, I mean, I can't go out and go shopping, and there's a lot of people mobbing me. Now I put this thing on, and I can go do my grocery shop. And you know, that was one reason. And then, you know, for example, I had my daughter was studying computer coding with a woman who was doing her PhD in computer science, and a cousin of mine who's a woman who runs a computer science artificial intelligence company out of Singapore, Pakistani woman based in Singapore, she said, I'll find you a perfect teacher. And so this woman comes to our house. And her face is covered and her head is covered, and she comes to our house, and I'm a bit surprised by this. And my daughter, I'm intrigued to see how this will go. I'm also somewhat, I suppose, at some level, apprehensive, right? Because I have stereotypes about what this might mean or what kind of person this might be. And my daughter sort of flounces out in her tutu and tank top and, like, you know, positions herself next to this computer coding. My daughter's 8. Computer coding teacher, and they get to work, and my daughter adores her. And it turns out my daughter like loves this woman. She's an amazing teacher. I get to know her, and she's like supporting her family and her parents through teaching, and also putting herself through PhD and helping her younger sisters. And she's this like supreme kind of, you know, icon of empowered womanhood, and also like funny and a brilliant teacher and very respectful and gentle with my daughter. And I started thinking, like, you know, how bogus my perception of what this human being was. And so I suppose, in a way, what Nadia's clothing means is what Nadia thinks it means. You know, it is not for you or I or anybody else to read into someone's choice of this garment as meaning something. It needn't mean the oppression of women, although it can. It can also mean the liberation of women if it is intended as such. The wearer, if it is worn freely, the wearer determines its meaning. And so I think that in Nadia's case, she chooses to keep wearing this garment. It means something to her. She says to us in the novel what she thinks it means. We may or may not find that she's speaking honestly. But for me, at least, it's a rebuke to myself, in a way, Nadia's way of dressing, to the narrow perspective that I myself have held towards this form of dress, and to my own misunderstandings of like the complete diversity of human beings who exist underneath that way of wearing clothing.
Hi. When you read, you spoke about, you did the passage with the woman in her house from multi-generations, and you spoke also about, in Lahore, the intergenerational nature of the home that you are in. And so I'm wondering, and you've also, there's, in Exit West in particular, there's a lot of relationships between family and what those connections mean, connections that are physical or connections that are, you know, ephemeral. I'm wondering what becoming a parent has done for what you may do in the future in terms of writing, or how you think about your responsibility in terms of your creative pursuits vis-a-vis all the things that you two have talked about tonight.
It's changed everything for me. You know, as a writer, I suppose also, and also nothing. I mean, it's like there are certainly things in my writing which are common from before and after, but I do feel profoundly altered by the experience of being a parent. Because, for example, in something as small as what characters do I give myself permission to write about? In my first couple of novels, I mostly gave myself permission to write about characters from similar contexts to my own, people who were my friends or my cousins or people I'd spent time with or I'd worked with or gone to school with, people of that milieu. Or, you know, they could be different from me, but encountered. I hadn't given myself permission to imagine myself into a character fundamentally different from, you know, at least on the outside. But having kids allowed me to think of human beings and characters as any character is somebody's child. Any character is potentially somebody's parent, potentially. And that brings in a kind of at least for me, permission. Like, I feel comfortable writing about an old woman in Palo Alto who has never been to Pakistan. I suppose feel more comfortable imagining myself as that old woman, because I think for writers, well, I shouldn't speak for all writers, for many writers, for myself, you know, we write characters that we can imagine being. I do, at least. And my sense of imagining being other people has expanded a lot since I've had kids, both in looking at them and understanding more about myself, not because they're necessarily like or unlike me, but because they are challenging my notions of what a human being, how they come and what makes them what they are and what is what they're taught and what is what they're built with and what their relationship with their parents are and with their grand. So it's made a big difference. Also, I think that in a sense, my first two novels are kind of, I would say, downers a little bit. You know, they, I wouldn't say they end on wonderfully optimistic notes. The third one is a kind of pivot, and that book was written when my daughter was very small. And this one does try to, in a sense, embrace something more hopeful. I think as a parent, it's kind of my job to find an optimistic world, even if that means struggling for an optimistic world. And that has affected my fiction. So yeah, I mean, moving to America, moving to Europe, moving to Pakistan, and moving to fatherhood have been probably my most important migrations, you know, as a writer.
I have two questions. The first one is for both of you. You've both used magical realism in your most recent books, Exit West and The Refugees. So I'm curious about the decision to use magical realism, especially because Exit West was the first time you've used magical realism. So with The Doors, I'm curious, you know, why that choice, and did it have the outcome you intended? And the other question is, I like this idea of we're all migrants through time. I think that's pretty cool. And I'm wondering, as it relates to your third novel, How to Get Rich, Filthy Rich in Rising Asia, if you thought about that, because the way that it ends kind of really unlocks that story and I think provides the ultimate happiness through that. So I guess kind of, did you have that idea as you were writing that book as well? And is that where the optimism comes in?
I'm going to start answering first. I'm going to forget both of those questions, and then I'm going to let Viet answer the one about magical realism. To your last question first, I imagined How to Get Filthy Rich in Rising Asia as not just a supposed self-help manual of how to actually get filthy rich, although I thought it should do so. It should be usable in that way, and apparently it has been assigned in business school classes, and which is bit weird, but I thought of that novel as a way of trying to take the material of an epic Sufi love poem, which is told to a beloved you, and explores whether love does in the end allow us a possibility of transcendence, and redeploy that in a very different vessel. A vessel that is not determined as belonging to a particular religious tradition, or any religious tradition necessarily, and functions in a different way, but while being true to some of the key elements of that form. And where I got to in the end of that book, the final sentence, was a sort of realization, which really is the genesis of Exit West. Like, Exit West builds from where Filthy Rich ends or gets to. On the magical realism point, I'll answer this very briefly. All of my books skew reality, right? In Mott Smoke, the events don't involve magical doors, but you, the reader, are cast as the surreal judge of a trial which clearly cannot be happening in this way. In The Rotten Fundamentalist, It's a dramatic monologue. With that, it's a hyper-stylized version of reality. Nobody would actually sit there for this extended conversation where one dude goes on and on and on for hours, the other one sort of scratches his chin and occasionally makes comments. It is a slightly skewed take on reality, even if the reality described is consensus reality. And then in How to Get Filthy in Rising Asia, it's 70 years of somebody's life, but no historical chronological time happens. There are CDs and DVDs in the beginning, and there are CDs, DVDs in the end. 70 years of a human being's life has passed, but no time has passed on the earth, which means, was this 12 different slices of 12 different lives being told at the same time in one city, or are they 12 different? Who knows? But the point is, it's slightly skew. And so for me, it was very natural in a way to take another slightly skew one, this one, which is The Doors.
I'll pass on answering the question because we have time for one more question.
Oh, okay.
I want to save that for you.
Assalamu alaikum. I wanted to say thank you so much for coming. My question is, you know, as someone who was actually born in Pakistan but spent almost the entirety of my life here, I've experienced a lot of alienization on both sides, you know, whether people, you know, approach my culture as a Pakistani as something to learn about and something that's very alien and something that's very new, or people approaching it from the other side as something that's alien and foreign and scary. I wanted to ask, as someone who's been in Pakistan, but as well as Europe and in America, what is kind of the alienization you've experienced and how has that affected your writing?
I mean, I've experienced, I think, something of what you did. When I came to California when I was 3 years old, my mother found me crying outside one of the identical townhouses in the Stanford University campus that we lived in with the other graduate students. And she stepped out. I was next door to our townhouse. And I was surrounded by a bunch of kids from all over the world, beautiful sort of Benetton commercial, like, you know, young United Nations of kids, three-year-olds, five-year-olds, six-year-olds. And they said, why can't he speak? What's wrong with him? Why doesn't he speak properly? My mother said, he does speak properly, he just doesn't speak English. And I was clearly very traumatized by this because they brought me into the house and I didn't speak for a month. And they thought, should we take him to a doctor, like whatever. I just sat down in front of the TV and watched TV for a month and didn't talk. And my dad said, no, he'll be okay. My mother said, this is not normal. A month later when I spoke in English in an American accent in full sentences. And 9 years later, when I moved back to Pakistan, they discovered I didn't speak a word of Urdu. I had lost everything. And when I went to Pakistan, I arrive in Pakistan, I don't speak a word of Urdu. And moving in those days was different from today. There was no Facebook, there was no email. Phone calls were ridiculously expensive. When I moved to Pakistan at the age of 9, I never heard, saw, had any contact ever again with anybody, any friend I'd had at that point in my life. None, right? The milk smelled different, and the bread was weird, and the TV was only on for a few hours a day, and there was no paper that would fit in my trapper keeper, and there's no Bactine, so the stuff they put on your stings like hurt like hell, and there's only cornflakes, and it was a weird kind of cornflakes, and it was a profound sense of like, what the hell has just happened, right? And so I adjusted, but. But I, twice in my early life, experienced this complete sense of like, what the hell has just happened to me? And I mean, to lose your way in life once, is bad luck. And, the second time is carelessness, to paraphrase Churchill, who is a very mixed figure, hero and sort of genocidal chemical weapons user all in one. What I discovered out of this was that I evolved a chameleon-like characteristic where I would try to be like whoever I was with. Already in America, I'm speaking in a more American accent than if I'm in Pakistan and I'm in London. It just happens naturally. It happens less now because now I try to sort of do it less. I kind of said, just let yourself be a little bit different and a little bit weird, because that's what you are. And it's something I've grown into, being comfortable being a little bit weird everywhere. But it's very reassuring to me to be able to be like that. When I was younger, I just didn't. I tried to be fully Pakistan in Pakistan, tried to be fully American in America. All I can say, and as you're on your own journey with this, is that if you get to know people, they feel weird too. You know, inside, these people who look like, you know, that there's nothing weird about them are as weird, probably much more weird than you are. And that's no real help in moments of feeling like strangely misunderstood and alienated, etc. Except that you have an enormous advantage. You are able to see the similarities between you and them and you and others in a way that many people, because of the handicap of their seeming similarity to those around them, lack. There's a potential for understanding and empathizing and recognizing humanity in individual people, which you have been, in a sense, gifted with, whether you want it or not, or perceive it as such, with an opportunity. And that's, you know, scant consolation when things feel very weird. But yet, I think it is an enormous potential. And other people have to work in a way much harder to recognize this. It is more open to those of us who've been forced to feel very different. And so all I can say is it isn't easy, but life isn't easy for other people too. And the sooner we all recognize that, the better off we are.
I want to thank you all for your wonderful questions. And to Mohsin as well for sharing his time with us.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, the estate of Suzanne Aaron, Donna and Martin J. Wolfe, Julia Meltzer, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM. Music by Boya Pongo. Support these free programs by becoming a member of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit lfla.org for more information. 17.